Unless you've been living off-planet someplace, like, I don't know, the last 40 years, you cannot fail to have recognized that music. Star Wars, the theme. Well, Star Wars The Force Awakens opens nationwide, worldwide, December 18th, and people are already buying tickets. Estimates for its first weekend have gone as high as $615 million, which, if it actually hits that number, would be a record-opening weekend and then some. So what is it about Star Wars that has imprinted itself onto the consciousness of four decades worth of moviegoers? What is it that appeals so much about Star Wars? Whether you're a fan or not, you've probably been affected by Star Wars, maybe even more than you know. Well, we're going to talk about that today on The Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen. She'll be back tomorrow. You can join our Star Wars discussion at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the usual number. That's why I'm giving it to you now and repeating it. You can also post to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page or send an email to talk@WPR.org. My guest is Chris Taylor, deputy editor of Mashable and author of the book How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, The Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion Dollar Franchise. And the book is out in paperback. The original hardcover has been newly updated and revised. And let's see. Okay, Chris Taylor is with us. Chris, good afternoon. Thanks for joining me on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
Good afternoon, John. It's good to be here.
So, it's hard to know where to start, and definitely it's hard to know where to end with a topic like this, because it's, when you say Star Wars, indeed, that opens up an entire universe, no pun intended. So, to you, let me ask this. We'll start out with the personal, and then we'll go out from there. What is Star Wars to you, and what's it meant to you?
Well, Star Wars came into my life in a very strange way. I probably tell that I'm not from around these parts. I grew up in the northeast of England, and the first time I actually encountered Star Wars, because we didn't actually have a movie theater in my town growing up, but we did have cereal boxes, and that's how I first encountered this franchise. There's a British cereal called Freddy's that produced a different scene from the movie every week on the back of the box. I followed those avidly, and then I got into the comic books, and I got into the action figures. And the movie, for me in my childhood, was almost an afterthought. Only when it came on British television in 1982 did I finally see what I'd been envisioning in my mind through the comic strips from a much younger age. So I kind of got the sense straight away that this was a franchise that was about more than just the movies. And that has certainly borne out today. And I cannot tell you how many parents have come up to me when I was writing this book and have said, my child knows the name of every character in Star Wars, every character in the novels, every character, of every Jedi and Sith ever invented, but they still haven't seen the film. How is this possible? And in part it's possible because the story of Star Wars spreads from mouth to mouth. It spreads on playgrounds across the world. But it's also just, this wonderful franchise that exists in every media, and there is really nothing like it on the planet right now.
Well, it's a $37 billion enterprise. I mean, it's just been unbelievably successful. And even if you haven't seen the movies, you probably played with the toys or, as you did, interacted with Star Wars on a cereal box.
That number, by the way, we keep having to revise that upwards as we get more information. And it's now roughly in the realm of $42 billion.
Wow. Well, a billion here, a billion there, and, pretty soon you're talking real money. A lot of people have tried to categorize Star Wars and have failed thoroughly. Why is that? Why is it so tough to categorize this film?
Well, for a start, people think, well, this is science fiction, right? It's set in space. There are blasters. There are, ships shooting at each other. It's got to be science fiction. It's got to be in the same realm as Star Trek, right? Just one word different. But that's not the case. It was, from the very start, it was envisioned by George Lucas as a fantasy. rather than science fiction. It just had to be fantasy set in a kind of a futuristic-looking universe, but as we all know, it's actually a galaxy long ago and far, far away. So, you know, it has that fairy tale element that used to be how George Lucas described it before he really kind of expanded the notion of it being a vast mythology. He called it the fairy tale. So it has this fantasy element, which I think is more appealing to people. You know, we saw that with Lord of the Rings, very popular fantasy franchise. So it's not surprising that a space fantasy would do the same thing. But the other way that George Lucas used to describe it was as a space opera. So, you know, it definitely has those soap opera elements to it, which are very popular. And, you know, Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker, his previous job was on General Hospital. So he was very used to the plot twists of, you know, the bad guy turning out to be his dad and his love interest turning out to be his sister, because he'd seen those soap opera twists at first hand. But yeah, I think that's really what appeals to the mainstream viewership of this kind of movie, that it's not just a thing for geeks. It's this very easy to understand family-based story, not just about a family, the Skywalker family, but also four families. And you know, it's a fantasy with mainstream appeal rather than esoteric science fiction.
Well, and I mean, you know, the major differences to a lot of people, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this because we could spend all hour and then follow that up with an argument over how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. Star Trek has always been, at least as a lot of us have understood it, more about science, and people have adventures mm-hmm. in the service of science, and while they're trying to discover things and be explorers, and conflict just kind of happens along the way. Whereas, as you describe it, Star Wars, the space opera part of that, it really resonates, I think, with people. It's a story, and they don't worry so much about the science. And you had an anecdote in your book about you know, some people overhearing a discussion about the science aspect of this. Who cares? What difference does it make if Star Wars, the science in Star Wars, isn't as realistic as the science in Star Trek? It doesn't matter.
Yes, and George Lucas himself was concerned about that. He thought, you know, people are going to come up to me and say, oh, there's no sound in space. How come those spacecraft are making noises, you know? And he just wanted to forget about all that and have fun. He says other times he wanted spaceships that people could get into and drive around as easily as cars. And, of course, car culture was very important to him. One of his first successful movie was American Graffiti. And Star Wars definitely has that car culture feel to it. There's low speed to it. You know, the Millennium Falcon feels like just this
it's a hot rod.
Duopi. Exactly. So it's, you know, it very much relates to American culture in any number of ways.
Well, Lucas didn't start out in life wanting to be a filmmaker. He wanted to be a race car driver, didn't he? How did he get from his interest in, you know, wanting to have some kind of a career related to racing to getting into film? Was there a moment where kind of decisions were made that he was going in a different direction? How did that play out?
The seminal moment with George Lucas always, and he's changed how he tells the story of his life over the years, but he has never changed this one essential factor, that it was really a car crash that he had, you know, at the age of 16. He was, you know, he was trying to graduate from school. He was really struggling. He'd actually been to the library, he'd been hitting the books, and then he comes back and he's just about to turn onto the road for his family home, and he gets hit from behind. And he gets, you know, he's lucky actually that he made his own seatbelt, because otherwise he would have been wrapped around a tree. Luckily the seatbelt snapped. But that was the point at which he, you know, after he survived that, he realized, well, maybe being a race car driver isn't for me. You know, I'll seriously go back to school this time. You know, he started looking into anthropology, which was really the beginnings of his interest in mythology. And that, you know, all those questions that led to the concept of the Force really came from that moment. And that's why he ends up going to film school. He was actually going to be a photography major. because his other big interest in life was taking photographs. But yeah, he definitely did not see himself as a film director.
800-642-1234, the number to call. We're talking about, some of the history behind Star Wars leading up to the seventh film in this franchise, which opens in December. People are already queuing up to buy tickets. Wondering what you think about this. How has this impacted your life? Maybe talk about the first time you saw the very first film in the series, which is Episode 4, and I guess that's a little confusing. Just in and of itself. But when you first saw that movie, how did it affect you? And if you continue to be a fan of Star Wars, what is it about that keeps you plunking down your money at the local multiplex to see successive films that have come out since that very first one in the 70s? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program this afternoon. And Chris Taylor is my guest. He's the author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, The Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion Dollar Franchise. How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, a little bit of a pun there from you, a reference something else in the past of George Lucas. Do you want to enlighten us?
Sure, yeah, it's a reference I think only about three people are going to get in this day and age. But
hey, it's public radio, so go for it.
There was a serial, it was one of the Flash Gordon serials, if anyone remembers those. They were a really big deal in the 30s and then became a big deal again on TV in the 50s. They turned out to be just the perfect length for TV stations that were hungry for content. Anyway, you had Flash Gordon, you had Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, and then you had Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe. And that is, that particular serial, which was sort of the most advanced of the three, is the one that George Lucas kept referencing again and again and again and again. And the one thing that I would always get from Lucasfilm is, look, you know, you have to be sure to say, you know, yes, all these other influences were important. He was definitely trying to make a commentary on Vietnam, for one thing. But really, at the root of it all, you know, this isn't necessarily a comic book movie. It's an homage to Flash Gordon, and in particular to Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe. And that's really what Lucas was trying to do, is go back to that sort of simpler time of, Saturday afternoon, Saturday morning matinee serials. Although Flash Gordon, when it came out, was actually a kind of a big deal, and they showed it in the evenings. You know, it was very much an adult drama, as strange as that is to think today. Mm-hmm. But it was very much the Star Wars of its era. And Lucas, you know, you look at some of those early scripts for the Star Wars, as it was called then, and they were pretty bad. Nobody makes any bones about that. It was described in the book as Flash Gordon fan fiction. That's pretty much the size of it.
George Lucas has never claimed to be a writer. And he really struggled with writing, and I want us to talk a little bit about that, and also the fact that the very first Star Wars film almost never got made at all. But we need to take a break.
Yeah.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll delve into that and take some calls. We've got a lot of people who want to talk about Star Wars this afternoon, and this is the hour to do it. We'll see how many calls we can get in and try and get through some of the questions that we have as well. Chris Taylor is my guest. He's the author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, and that's the book under discussion. We'll take a quick time out and we'll come back and we'll have more of our discussion at 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, or post a comment or question to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
There is no escape. Don't make me destroy you. Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side. Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
We're talking about Star Wars this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen. Of course, that the big reveal in the second film in the series, Episode 5, that was the big plot twist there that came right at the almost the very end of the film. Chris Taylor is my guest. He's the author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. So that clip from the second film, but the very first one didn't get made, as I understand it. United Artists had the first rights to it, and you mentioned that it was, at that time, the title was The Star Wars. They had first refusal. They turned it down. Universal Pictures had the second chance at it. They just ignored it. Disney said no, which is kind of ironic in hindsight. Without going into too many details, we only have a little over half an hour left here, but without going into too many details... Give us the route that Star Wars took from an obscure set of notes in a George Lucas notebook to the film that was eventually released and captured the public's attention so thoroughly.
Well, it's interesting because the early drafts of the movie were just inscrutable, and nobody that Lucas gave them to could really understand them. So it's not surprising that United Artists turned it down, that Universal turned it down, as you say, and then, you know, really when it got to Fox, when, you know, 20th Century Fox finally picked it up, and it was Alan Ladd Jr., known as Laddy, who really championed it. Even he was not entirely clear what was going on here, and it really took Lucas. Basically acting the movie out and referencing old movies that Laddie knew. You know, this part's going to be like The Three Musketeers. This part's going to be like Captain Blood. That's when it finally clicked for him. But, yeah, nobody had seen special effects that were going to look like this. It was so new that Lucas had a really hard time getting studio executives to picture it. And, you know, the artist Ralph McQuarrie was a big help. There were some wonderful paintings that McQuarrie did that really galvanized what these creatures looked like for a lot of people. Because if you were to just say droids or Wookiees to someone in the early 70s, they would have looked at you like you were crazy. So, yeah, it took a lot of explaining.
Well, the film eventually did get made, and that's stating in a sentence something that was years in the making, but it eventually did get made. Lucas had no idea how huge this thing was, and how long did it take him to figure out that he had a huge hit on his hands?
Well, a couple of days. I mean, so first of all, his expectations were, you know, it's probably going to be a disaster, but if it's any good, it might make $12 million, which is about what the average Disney movie was pulling in at that point. And, you know, he was at one point arguing to Fox that, look, we've got at least $8 million worth of science fiction fans who will want to see this thing. You know, so once the movie is done, he's absolutely spent. He didn't really stick around long enough to see the crowds form outside the theaters, even though he was having lunch right outside one of those theaters. He didn't even realize it was his own movie that the crowds were queuing up for. So he went to Hawaii straight after the original movie came out, May 25th, 1977. And, you know, spent 3 days in Hawaii with his wife, the first vacation they'd had in a long, long time. And only finally, you know, when Alan Ladd Jr. gets hold of him on the phone, says, "Hey, turn on CBS, turn on Walter Cronkite," you know, and he sees Walter Cronkite reporting on these huge lines outside the movie theaters. That's the point at which Lucas finally gets it, and he overcomes his natural pessimism and realizes that it's a hit, and now he has to do another one.
Yeah, your reward for success is you get to do it over again.
Well, he really wanted to. I mean, his goal at that stage was really to cement space fantasy as a popular genre, and he did that very successfully with The Empire Strikes Back. And really, when you look at what he was doing with that film, he was basically, he was being a good businessman, and he was building in insurance policies for all of his characters, you know, in case the actors didn't want to do future movies. So, you know, Harrison Ford had not yet signed up for a third film. That's why he got put in Carbonite. And that's why we got Lando Calrissian as sort of the backup Han Solo type character, you know, which is what he very much was. This is why there was Yoda talked about there being another, you know, when Luke flies away in Empire, you know, it's there goes our last hope, says Obi-Wan. Yoda says, no, there's another. That wasn't originally supposed to refer to Leia. It was supposed to be Luke has this secret sister who isn't Leia, who's on the other side of the galaxy, also being trained as a Jedi. So, you know, he really thought, at that point, he thought he could put 12 movies together. And it was only after the horrible experience of trying to film Empire Strikes Back that he kind of reneged on that and said, okay, let's just do three and call it quits for now.
Mm. We have callers who want to join us. Janine is with us in Burlington. We'll go there first. Janine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's nice to hear from you guys. I was 9 years old when the first movie came out, and I live in a small town. It's, as of today, there's 10,500 people in our city. And going to the movie theater was just always so much fun and important. So as a 9-year-old, it blew me away, and I just remember being wide-eyed, and every time a new movie came out, we would go and see it, and it was just a very enjoyable childhood memory, and I will definitely see the new one.
All right, Janine, thanks for the call. I think probably Chris Taylor, a lot of people would have shared Janine's experience of seeing the first film and being hooked.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, everyone loved it at every age, pretty much, everyone who saw it. But when you're at that age and you see it in the theater for the first time, there's nothing like it in the world, no special effects like that. I mean, you know, today we are just suffused in our culture with special effects and, you know, CGI. It's everywhere. You can't turn on the TV without seeing it. But back then, absolutely nothing like it. And it was really, you know, Lucas was definitely aiming this at children of that age. He wanted to create more of a mythology, more of a basic story of good and evil for kids that age. And interestingly, I mean, some of his earliest fans were the children of the young sons of Francis Ford Coppola, who were around about 9 and 10 at the time and became, you know, two of the earliest fans of Star Wars. And they got it, you know, even when the grown-ups didn't really understand what George was talking about.
Hey, you mentioned Francis Ford Coppola. George Lucas was part of a cohort, if you could call it, of film directors. Coppola would be one, Scorsese, a number of other directors who challenged the studio, the old time studio system in Hollywood, and really kind of changed the landscape as far as getting films made. Talk about that a little bit and the legacy of the film directors who came out of that late 60s, early 70s period.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely, it's the period that starts with Easy Riders. You know, Easy Rider in late 68 just blew everyone away and kickstarted this whole era, the young enfant terrible of cinema. But the sort of the traditional narrative is that it was, you know, it was Scorsese and Coppola, and they were producing all these edgy films, and then Spielberg and Lucas came along and they did their, you know, cutesy special effects films, starting with Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and then that was what changed the equation, and then suddenly you couldn't get these, you know, the Taxi Driver or Chinatown like films made. What I really discovered in writing this book was that everyone in the 70s, every director, you know, Brian De Palma, Scorsese, everyone wanted to do a good science fiction film. And they just couldn't find the right material. They couldn't find the right special effects. So they, you know, the script wasn't quite right. And it was really just that Lucas and Spielberg were first to this genre. And they, you know, they really knuckled down and did it. But it could have turned out entirely differently. I mean, we often forget that George Lucas was supposed to direct Apocalypse Now, and was attached to direct it for many, many years, until Coppola came to him right when he was working on Star Wars and said, you know, look, you got to choose. I want to make this now. You know, just come out of Godfather 2. I want to, you know, don't want to do any more movies on dark sets. I want to go out to the jungle. And Lucas had to turn him down and say, no, I really want to focus on Star Wars. But he easily could have gone the other direction and be known today as a, you know, Vietnam War director.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, we don't get to see the sausage being made when we go to the multiplex and watch a film. We don't know what the struggles the people went through to get it to that point. American Graffiti, case in point, even after Lucas got the film made, he had trouble getting it released. And people don't often think about the fact that the director doesn't always have control of how the work is used ultimately. What were some of George Lucas's struggles with the various studios that he had to work with, and how did that inform his later decisions to form his, well, he had his own company, but to kind of, to really work independently of that?
Well, Lucas had really, he had good luck and bad luck. He had good luck in that he was in the right place at the right time to get noticed. He had a wonderful mentor in the shape of Coppola, who, without whom he really wouldn't have been a director, and he certainly wouldn't have tried to write film scripts without Coppola's encouragement. But he, you know, once he got his first movie deal, which was THX-1138, if anyone has seen that film, they know that it's very kind of depressing and very much like an independent, you know, film, a student film, which is exactly what it was based on. You know, and he took that to Warner Brothers, who he had the deal with, and they just flipped out. You know, they canceled all these other deals that they'd made with Lucas and Coppola's company, which is actually the reason that Coppola had to go off and make The Godfather in the first place. And they cut 5 minutes from the film, which made absolutely no difference to the film, but it sort of cemented Lucas's vision that, you know, the studios are evil, they don't know what they're doing, it's the directors that should be in charge. And then on American Graffiti, he had the same experience. You know, he everyone loved that film except this one guy at Universal who was in charge of releasing it, and he hated it. He was this manic depressive guy who just really didn't understand what Lucas was trying to do with this, you know, sweet, funny little film about car culture. And again, cut 5 minutes from the film. So Lucas really had the bad luck of getting these studio executives who just wanted to mutilate his movies. And, you know, from that point on, from Star Wars onwards, he was absolutely just rigorously dead set on having the movie look the way he wanted it to look. And that really sort of informed the rest of his career and why he built Skywalker Ranch, why he ran Lucasfilm the way he did, and why he's sort of not really recognized for this, but he's one of the biggest independent movie makers of all time.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join our Star Wars conversation this afternoon. Rich is with us next from Spooner. Rich, good afternoon. Thanks for being here. Go ahead.
Hi. Just a couple of comments. First time I saw Star Wars, I was working at Grand Canyon, and the village had a little community center with chairs that were attached to plywood to slide around. We had old carbon arc projectors, and it was just really pretty cool. I don't know how many times I saw it, but I was hooked. Every time I watched it, there was always something that I could pick out of it that I hadn't seen before or noticed before. And one of the things that my other comment, it seems like there are sort of some parallels with Irish mythology and father son.
No, Rich, we're losing you. Rich is talking about some of the mythology that Lucas drew on, and he's suggesting maybe there was some Irish mythology in there in Star Wars. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he mentioned the father-son connection there, and that shows up time and again in world literature. I mean, if you think of the plot of Oedipus Rex, you know, it's basically a man confronting his father and not realizing who he is and ending up killing the guy. And, you know, that's definitely echoed in the Darth Vader Luke Skywalker relationship. It's also, I mean, I found a couple of examples from Lucas's comic book reading of situations where characters found out that their fathers were bad guys. You know, and this is an obscure little comic book strips that no one else but George Lucas was talking about. You know, things like Tommy Tomorrow. It used to be in Action Comics. And so, you know, it was definitely not a new idea. and, you know, you could say the same for a lot of the mythological aspects of Star Wars, that it was drawn from, you know, timeless myths. And Lucas definitely spent a lot of time reading up on mythology. We often associate it with Joseph Campbell and, you know, The Power of Myth, a series that was actually filmed at Skywalker Ranch. But really it was, I mean, Lucas was reading long before he discovered Joseph Campbell, and there were many other books in the 70s that he drew on, mm-hmm. And that had much more influence on his later films. But yeah, that's absolutely what he was thinking of. All of world mythology, you know, boiled down to a single story, and all of the world's religions boiled down to a single concept in the Force, which really still works today to the point where, you know, it's the Force is basically a concept of God that even atheists can agree with.
I want to come back to that, and first we need to take another break, and when we come back I want to talk about the Force, because some people have actually tried to make a religion out of it with more or less success depending on your point of view. And then the whole phenomenon of, we've got all this cosplay, there's actually an organization that's dedicated to dressing up in stormtrooper uniforms and going around to functions, and they have some official capacity. There's just a lot of stuff that's happened, and plenty more to talk about, and your calls as well at 800-642-1234. Chris Taylor is my guest. He's the author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, The Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion-Dollar Franchise, $42 billion and counting. This thing is worth. It's huge. It has its own planetary gravity, I think, practically. This thing is really big. Anyway, we're going to keep talking about it for the rest of the hour, and hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Who are you?
I'm no one.
A little bit of audio from the trailer for Star Wars, and when a snippet of that was first released to the public, it got, I don't know, 80 million hits in the first 24 hours or some crazy number like that. People are just hungry for anything about the new film, Episode 7, which comes out December 18th. We're talking about the Star Wars franchise this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show with Chris Taylor, the author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. I want to talk about the upcoming release of this new film. What did you make of last year's announcement by Lucasfilm that all of the Star Wars books, comics, and games were no longer, quote, part of the official continuity, end quote? What does that mean, and should we be concerned that that J.J. Abrams is going to reboot the Star Wars franchise like he did with Star Trek?
Well, I think it was an effort to avoid a reboot, and I've described it many times as kind of a very drastic operation where they basically had to amputate all the limbs from the patient, but the patient survived. Yeah, I mean, there have been hundreds of novels, I think at least 250 novels, and 1,000 comic books, you know, that told the stories between the films and the stories before Episode One, the stories after Return of the Jedi, which until this December is the most recent in the canon. And they got very, very confused and contradictory, and some of them were great, some of them not so much. There were some very weird books, like the Courtship of Princess Leia, where Han Solo actually kidnaps Princess Leia and, you know, tries to basically force her to marry him at gunpoint. I mean, just sort of bizarre choices like that that didn't really work. And it was quite telling that I think some of the biggest fans of, you know, of these novels, what used to be known as the Expanded Universe, were actually, when Lucasfilm made this announcement, they were like, yeah, you know, that's fair enough. These were not particularly great works of literature, although they definitely have their fans. There are a lot of people who are annoyed, who said that they would boycott the new content until, you know, until Lucasfilm continued the old story. But I think for the majority of us, we realized that, yes, you kind of needed to get rid of a lot of this content, or not even get rid of it, but just, I think, rebranding it Legends, as they did, was probably a very smart move. And, you know, and start afresh. And the advantage of that is that we don't know what has been happening in the galaxy for the last, you know, 30 years of in-story time. And then it's all a mystery to us when we go into the theater, which is just as it should be.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Force? Some people have actually tried to make a religion out of it, and that's been a little bit problematic, hasn't it?
Mm. Well, so I looked into this for the book, and you know that we talk a lot about the census campaigns, where you know this actually started off in New Zealand, just to give you a sense of the global interest that there is in this franchise. It started off with a chain email encouraging people in New Zealand to put down Jedi as their religion on their census forms, and then that spread to Australia. I think in both countries, you know, Jedi quickly became the second largest religion overnight that people noticed on their forms. It went to the UK, it got even bigger, you know, Canada, same deal. In the US, I don't believe that there is, you know, religion, a space for a religion on the census form. So, you know, we'll never know how many Jedi there are in this country. But, you know, I'm sure it would be a pretty sizable amount. And actually, you know, we were talking about Francis Ford Coppola earlier. He was the one who tried to encourage George Lucas to take the Force and make a Scientology-style religion out of it. And Lucas was just horrified by that idea. He was, you know, he's no L. Ron Hubbard. He's kind of a shy, retiring guy. He just wants to stay in the background and make his films. So he was not a big fan of that idea. But it's interesting to ponder that there might have been this alternate universe in which we do have, you know, a Jedi-like religion. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, there are a lot of groups who have decided to learn how to wield lightsabers, and they build their own customized, you know, LED-based lightsabers and do some pretty spectacular things with them. So yeah, it's quite fun to see. But that's the biggest impact that, you know, the Force as a religion has had on our planet, is that there are a lot of Jedi running around.
Well, and there are a lot of stormtroopers running around as well. In fact, there's a worldwide organization. They show up at events. They have chartered local groups. Talk a little bit about that, and then we've got a bunch of phone calls I want to get to as well.
Yeah, very briefly, they're called the 501st Legion, you know, which is one guy's idea. Actually, a guy who was an amputee, is based in South Carolina, Alban Johnson, and he just tried dressing up as a stormtrooper and got a friend to dress up as a stormtrooper for the release of the Star Wars Special Editions in 1997. And just, you know, he said his big ambition was to try to get 10 people together all dressed up as stormtroopers. And, you know, maybe they could go to the local comic book store. And now you have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people around the world who are members of the 501st Legion. They all build their own stormtrooper armor, which is very interesting. They don't buy, you know, pre-made stuff. They're out there in the garages day after day hammering away at this PVC piping, basically, is what it is, to make your own stormtrooper costume. But they're a fantastic force, if you pardon the pun, in the Star Wars world. And Lucasfilm uses them quite a lot for events. If you ever see commercials with a stormtrooper in, it's almost certainly the 501st Legion. And now they've started doing these Star Wars days at ballparks. If you've ever been to a baseball game, where you see Star Wars characters, that's the 501st Legion. So, yeah,
wow.
They're everywhere.
That's incredible. Let's go back to the phones. Angela is with us in Neenah. Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Hello. I was fortunate to have my very first job be working at the theater. And so one of the very first weekends I had was Star Wars. And like you said before, never seen anything like this before. So then I had to call my brother, who was 11 at the time, and said, you have to see this movie. So he watched it with me during the second showing that night. But then fast forward, you know, several years later, I'm married, I have a son, and my husband and I are like, when can we show this to Matt? And so he was 5. And by the end of the movie, he was like up on the top of the couch, get him, Luke, get him, Luke. And we had to, of course, then get him lightsabers. And I had to, you know, sew him a Luke Skywalker costume. And he was Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader for Halloween for several years. So we have instilled Star Wars love in a very young child.
Angela, thanks for sharing that story.
Yep.
That's great. Let's see. Let's go to Anthony in Kenosha next. Anthony, hello. How you doing? Oops, I got to push the right button.
Fine.
Now we got it. Anthony, go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much. Hey, I was my Star Wars story is that I was living in upstate New York at the time when it came out. Didn't see the film immediately. My family, we didn't go to movies. Finally, we went to go see the movie, and it was sold out. And my mother did not want to wait for the next showing. So instead, I got to see the Shaggy D.A. I hate that movie. I still remember sitting there thinking, this movie stinks. And I got immersed as a kid into all the Star Wars stuff and didn't see the movie until I believe they re-released it. It came back out in the theatrical release later. So I had figures, I had comics, I had all this stuff, but I never saw the movie. And then finally, when I went to see the movie, it was more than anything I ever dreamed of. None of the paraphernalia I had could live up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just blown away by it. Your last caller talked about her 5-year-old. Might have her beat a little bit. My grandson's name is Anakin. His sister's name is Jaina.
Wow.
Which is Han Solo's sister's name, I believe.
That's hardcore. That's yeah. Hardcore, that is. Anthony, thank you so much for sharing your story. Didn't see the films until late, but was immersed in the culture of it all. You talk a lot about that in your book. You were trying to find people, Chris Taylor, who'd never seen Star Wars, and that was a real challenge to find anybody who's, you know, if we were trying to impanel an impartial jury on some Star Wars-related thing, we'd have a pretty tough time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not just, you know, I started off finding people, you know, in my own workplace who hadn't seen Star Wars, and we showed the movie to them, and they would say things like, oh, yeah, you know, I recognize this scene. I recognize that guy in the with the black helmet, you know. He was in the VW commercial for the Super Bowl. You know, so it's so widespread in our culture that you get, you know, tainted isn't quite the right word, but you get exposed to it through all sorts of different means, even if you haven't seen the film. So my job in the very beginning of the book was to try to find one person who not only hadn't seen it, but had never heard of it. And I had to go all the way to Window Rock, Arizona, the capital of the Navajo Nation, for the first screening of Navajo in of Star Wars in Navajo. It was called Navajo Star Wars. And it was actually the first movie that's ever been translated into a Native American language. And, you know, there I found one old Army veteran. He was actually one of the code talkers from World War II. He'd fought at Iwo Jima. 88-year-old guy, and he lives in the mountains, and he was the first guy who hadn't even heard of the title of the movie. And when I, you know, when I mentioned the title to him, he said something like, oh, what, the stars are at war? I don't get it. But that, you know, that's how you get a sense of just how big the impact has been on our culture. You know, it's it's kind of like the water that fish swim in. You know, they couldn't describe it because it's ubiquitous. And it's the same for us. We see it, mm-hmm. you know, we see its influence so many times every day. We see the logo out of the corner of our eyes on someone's T-shirt or lunchbox or, you know, it's just, it's everywhere. And, yeah, you know, finding someone, you know, I'm actually going down to Brazil later this year for the launch of the book there, and I'm hoping I can get some time to go into the Amazon jungle and try and find some of the natives there who maybe have never heard of this movie. I think that's about as far as I'm going to have to go to find anyone else, because, you know, as I say in the book, and I won't reveal how, but even my friend, the Navajo co-talker, had actually, it turned out, seen a little bit of the movie on TV.
What are your expectations for episode 7? I mean, we had a little bit of a letdown, I think, for a lot of people when episodes 1, 2, and 3 came up as follow-up films mm-hmm. to the original 4, 5, and 6. And what are your expectations for episode 7?
Well, I'm keeping them purposely very low, so hopefully I can be pleasantly surprised. But yeah, I mean, the prequel movies were very controversial. There were a lot of people who liked them, generally on the younger side, though not exclusively. But they still, I mean, they were still huge hits. Let's not forget the biggest Star Wars movie in terms of, you know, real dollar amounts, was The Phantom Menace, was episode one, you know, in terms of, just the worldwide gross. It was a lot more popular in other countries than it was in the U.S. But this one is different in the sense that it's not George Lucas directing anymore. You know, Lucas always had this very different vision of what Star Wars was, and he wasn't able to quite reach that vision in the early films, in the first three films, you know, to our relief, as it turns out, because he really wanted this kind of big, goofy movie with tons of aliens and spaceships and none of the dialogue making a whole lot of sense. That was his vision of Star Wars. Ours was something a little more different, a little more like a Western. And I think that, you know, J.J. Abrams has kind of signaled over the last couple of years that he's more into the Western vision of Star Wars, that's what it's about. It's a little more adult, a little more edgy, a little more dangerous, a little less about the CGI, a little less about the goofy creatures like Jar Jar Binks. So, yeah, you know, I'm pretty hopeful. JJ gets it. And everything we've seen in the trailers so far it just looks fantastic. And, well, yeah, got my fingers crossed.
Well, from the trailer, it certainly looks dark.
It really does. I mean, you played a little bit of it earlier. I mean, it's funny, there's this trailer that's been viewed, you know, I think it was 116 million times in the first 24 hours. Just opens with this very dark images of our new heroine, Rey, played by Daisy Ridley, you know, just on her own inside a vast Star Destroyer. And it's not necessarily what you would expect. Yeah, I think they are going for a little bit of that kind of darker Empire Strikes Back kind of feel. So that's very hopeful as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, it opens on December 18th, and people are already queuing up to buy tickets. I didn't look today to see what the current number of tickets that had already been sold. That's one advantage today over 1977. People can go online and buy tickets, but this looks like it'll be a huge hit before it's ever even released. Chris Taylor, thanks for being here today and talking with us about this, and thank you for writing this book. I have to say I really enjoyed reading it.
Oh, thank you, John. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Chris Taylor, author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. It's available now in paperback. It's newly updated. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for booking this hour of programming and also for handling on-air production. Thanks, as always, to Dave Potratz, who handled the technical aspects of this with his usual aplomb. Thanks to you for listening and for calling in. Appreciate you as well. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen is back tomorrow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.